Going beyond the headlines to the deeper issues. 96.3 WHUR and HUR Voices, Sirius XM Channel 141. This is the Inside Segment, where your questions and comments matter at 202-319-7810. Join the conversation.
Welcome back to the Daily Drum on WHUR and Sirius XM Channel 141. This is the Inside Segment. I'm Harold Fisher. What a political year it's been, and it's not over yet. A lot of the information you're getting is because of the intrepid journalists who have been covering election 2020 from various and sundry angles. Well, tonight, we're at the Reporters Roundtable to talk to the reporters and analysts who are laser-focused on the candidates and the issues as we get closer to Election Day. We have several perspectives tonight from the Fourth Estate. We begin with Kelly Macias, editor-at-large for Black Women Unmuted, and Dr. Michael Fauntroy, political science professor at Howard University. And you. Lines are open at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Tweet me at HFisher, WHUR, or find me on Instagram at Harold T. Fisher. Michael, Kelly, thank you both for joining the conversation.
Oh, it's my pleasure, man.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Let me start with you, Kelly. We already know that this is the most unique, unusual, strange, bizarre, colorful, multi-textured election in recent memory, quite possibly modern history. But beyond the obvious, from your perspective, why is it? Is it the candidates, or is it the issues?
Yeah, so I want to say, Harold, that I think all the adjectives you used to describe this election cycle are right on. It is probably the most contentious and bizarre in modern history. And I think it's actually both. I think it's the candidates and the issues. In terms of the candidates, I mean, we have one candidate, Joe Biden, who represents continuity and stability for a lot of people, what we can already expect. And he's tied to one of the more popular past presidents. And, you know, he's up against an incumbent who is wildly unpopular, who has made his political career out of doing the unexpected, who, you know, every day is something new and different and harmful to a lot of people. But I also think in this particular election, the issues really matter to folks. And that's actually unusual because a lot of folks aren't paying attention to some things that might often be considered inside baseball for folks. For example, the Supreme Court. You know, very few people in past elections have thought about the Supreme Court, maybe a little in 2016. But, you know, in past years, it's not been a significant motivator for voters. This time it is. You know, we know that the incumbent president has appointed not only three Supreme Court justices, but also has filled nearly, I think, over 200 vacancies at the federal court level. So people are really concerned about voting rights and reproductive rights and environmental justice and health care. Speaking of health care, we're in the middle of this global pandemic, right, where more than 227,000 Americans have died. And the, you know, incumbent president is still campaigning in ways that are not safe. You know, there's no agreement in his administration about how we combat the pandemic and what we need to do. So I think in this case, it's both the issues and the candidates. Mm.
Michael, from an analyst's perspective and as it relates to, you know, to commentary, I'm sure you don't mind me saying you've been around for a minute. And you've had an opportunity to make some observations relevant to this campaign, this election season versus 2016 or 2008 or 2004 or 2000. How does this compare? I'd hate to ask you to give it a grade. Maybe you can give it a grade for intensity. How about that?
Well, I give grades for a living, so yeah, I'm going to give it a grade. it's funny. This is the oddest, most convoluted, and crazy presidential campaign I've ever seen. And part of that is because we have an incumbent. And by the way, incumbents have an enormous advantage going into reelection. If folks want to understand why some members of Congress have been there for 30 and 40 years, it's because of the power of incumbency, right? Incumbent presidents actually should not be losing unless there's something really bad going on. And in this case, obviously, there is something really bad going on with COVID-19 and a variety of other things. But I just think that, you know, to your question with regard to, you know, what's causing all this, it is absolutely a confluence of a variety of things. We now have been living in very sketchy economic circumstances for some people going back to 2008. You may recall during the 2008 presidential campaign, you know, the economy was heading nowhere and there was a big stimulus package that was passed, and that ended up taking over the campaign. And and many people had to delay their retirements. They couldn't pay to send their kids to school as they had initially planned, and a variety of other economic issues that got in the way. And for some people who are just now digging out of that, you then have this. So there's a whole bunch of economic uncertainty. There's racial and social uncertainty. There's healthcare uncertainty. Virtually everything that could be going wrong right now outside of sort of a war is going on right now. And so what we are dealing with is different than anything we've ever seen. I liken it to 1968 because of the civil unrest in the streets. But even 1968 doesn't measure up to this because it didn't have the same level of economic anxiety and uncertainty.
202-319-7810. 202-319-7810. We're at the Reporters Roundtable as we talk about coverage of the 2020 election. What do the journalists have to say as they, day in and day out, focus on the issues and the candidates in this really unusual place that we're in right now? If you have a comment or a question, give us a call in 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. So, Kelly, one of the things that Michael just mentioned, he talked about, you know, social unrest. What part, and you're down in Georgia, so what part do you believe that the killing of Rayshard Brooks, for example, and Ahmaud Arbery, what part do those killings play in the what voters are thinking about, sharing, talking about? What's your perspective on that?
Sure. Well, just a point of context, I'm not in Georgia. I'm actually in D.C., not far from the studios, but I've been covering Georgia since 2017. So I think what's driving voters in Georgia right now is a combination of things. I mean, clearly the racial unrest and things that have happened specifically in Georgia, and so folks are definitely looking at that. I think also, you know, we've had massive voter suppression in Georgia over the last several years, voters being purged from the polls. We've had people, you know, polling locations closed. We also had the gubernatorial race in 2018, right, where there was massive voter turnout for the Democratic candidate, Stacey Abrams, who lost by marginal numbers, and very many people thought that Stacey actually had won and that this was a result of voter suppression. And so I think that this time around, all of those things are driving turnout. We've seen record turnout in Georgia for early voting, and I think we can see that up until next Tuesday. But I think it's a combination of the racial unrest, of course, and also the massive voter suppression turnout and the results of the election in 2018.
202-319-7810. 202-319-7810. We're at the Reporters Roundtable talking about election 2020. If you have a comment, if you have a question, I want to hear from you. What do you think? We're talking to the journalists, their perspectives on how this issue is being, you know, covered, how it is being, you know, addressed. And, you know, and to that point, one of the things that I find really interesting, Michael, is, and this is a little also, again, some historical perspective, and correct me if I'm wrong, I cannot honestly remember or remember reading about the kind of pressure that the, you know, the for example, the Trump administration, the President Trump specifically, or other candidates have placed on journalists, print journalists, TV journalists, mm-hmm. broadcasters, and the like, not since Watergate and Richard Nixon. Can you give me some perspective on what journalists are really facing? Look at what happened to Leslie Stahl at 60 Minutes just last yeah. week. You know, security guards for a veteran journalist who has a reputation for being really fair. The president attacks her. Now she's got to have, you know, her own protection. What's going on here?
So, as you know, most elected officials at that level would rather not deal with media at all.
Right? No.
At all. And that's particularly the case here because President Trump has such a negative relationship with the truth and with facts that he's always on edge that he's going to be called out for his lies. And so, unlike Richard Nixon, who is on audio tape complaining about media and putting together an enemies list, and Ronald Reagan, during his administration, sort of conservative thought leaders began to coalesce around this idea that the media was the enemy and we needed to stand up our own media operations. You know, we've never seen that compared to now. I mean, even that was mild compared to what we see now. But with the proliferation of media outlets, where you can go exactly where you want to go to hear what reconfirms what's in your own mind as a consumer of media, and the intense competition for viewers and readers, I think that what we're seeing right now is the natural outgrowth of a president who in some respects was created by the media. And that he had a particular narrative that he was able to construct and sell to the public. People bought it hook, line, and sinker, and it didn't seem to matter to them that the truth about who he was and what he was about contradicted the narrative that they had already purchased. So, yeah, we live in a different world right now. And I think that one of the things that we're seeing right now in terms of the contrast between both President Trump and former Vice President Joe Biden is really also about the traditional way in which presidential candidates and politicians generally have been viewed by the media and candidates who are running for office. Joe Biden is that sort of comfortable sweater that you wear on the weekends that everybody knows about, and Donald Trump is a very unpredictable vehicle of some sort that you can't really control. And ultimately, if the numbers are trending, are what they seem to be trending to be, the voters are making it clear, at least at this point, that they've been wrung dry by all of this drama and are ready to move on.
Yeah, we said the same thing in 2016, too. So, and then we saw how that turned out. So,
But Harold, here's what's different, though. The polling, even if it is off in 2020 the way it was off in 2016, still gives Joe Biden a substantial cushion. Mm-hmm. And Donald Trump now is running on a record. He didn't have anything to wow. defend then. Yeah. And that I think for a lot of never Trumpers, that's gonna be a really big deal.
I want you to chime in on that, Kelly, in a minute. But first, I want to take a phone call here. 202-319-7810. 202-319-7810. Jerry on the line. Thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Yeah, thank you. I just wanted to ask, you know, in addition to this being a presidential election year, it's also the decade of the census. The census was taken. And I wanted to ask, what role do you think the Browning of America and the inevitability that the white race would become a minority, and this census pointing to it more and more, you know, what do you think that played into presidential politics? You know, the Trump administration that tried to suppress the black and brown count. You know, they're sacking the Supreme Court seemingly to get their ducks in order for the time when black and brown people will be the majority in this country. I'll hold and wait for your response.
Well, thank you so much for that. Kelly, you want to take a shot at that real quick? I've got about 2 minutes before the break.
Sure. I mean, I think it's an excellent question, and I think we've seen that. You know, we saw Donald Trump's run in 2016 on a platform that was very loud dog whistles related to making America white, you know, keeping America white. And so I think all of the efforts we've seen, you know, with the court stacking, with the trying to stop the census count, with, you know, all of the policies that we've seen that disproportionately hurt and impact black and brown communities is about that. I also think the election of Donald Trump is about that. You know, when people talked about President Obama making race relations worse, I actually heard that as people feeling that he made them think about race for the first time, right, and feeling a distance between themselves and their government, feeling a distance between themselves and power. So I absolutely think the census also, you know, plays a role in how, the browning of America really, has caused a lot of racial anxiety and unrest among white people who've always been in power.
Jerry, thank you so much for your thoughtful question. 202-319-7810. 202-319-7810. We are at the Reporters Roundtable. We are talking about covering election 2020 from the journalist's point of view. If you have a comment, if you have a question, if you have some thoughts that you want to share about it as it relates to today's topic, give us a call again at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Dr. Michael Fauntroy, thank you so much for joining this conversation. I know we're going to let you go. We have another guest coming up. Kelly is going to be continue to stay with us. So thank you so very much. Stay with us. If you're on the phone, the Daily Drum will continue on Sirius XM, Channel 141. I'm Harold Fisher. John Mons is next with the original Quiet Storm on WHUR. This discussion continues on Sirius XM, Channel 141 in just a bit. 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. We'll be back in a moment. Welcome back to the Daily Drum on Sirius XM, Channel 141. I'm Harold Fisher. We continue at the Reporters Roundtable talking about coverage of election 2020 in a most unusual, strange political year. We continue with Kelly Macias, editor-at-large for Black Women Unmuted. Joining us now, Sherry Gregg, a Philadelphia-based journalist and past president of the Philadelphia chapter of the National Association of Black Journalists. Lines are still open at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Certainly you can find me on Twitter at HFisherWHUR or on Instagram at Harold T. Fisher. Okay, Sheree, thank you so much for joining the conversation.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. You are the perfect person to talk to because I have said, I've made this statement, my opinion, that never before do I believe that black media has been more relevant in recent history than right now because of all of the issues that have popped up during the course of this crucial election. How far off am I?
I think you're pretty close on. And I will say not just black owned media, but black journalists generally, because in traditional media outlets, we are desired right now. You see a lot of journalists making moves because you need us in the newsroom. I mean, we're covering COVID-19. We were covering an election, racial injustice, and our voices were very needed and much wanted to be listened to. I know in Philadelphia, we have a strong coalition of black journalists, and we have been so busy. Let me just tell you that
We're having racial unrest in our city right now, rioting and looting for the past couple of days following yet another killing of a black man, Walter Wallace Jr. I just spoke to his family in a sit-down interview today, and you know, this, we've had multiple people lose their lives who have mental illness at the hands of police, and they usually are black and brown. And these are the types of topics that black journalists and black media tend to cover.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, Kelly, outside of those really, you know, big, dare I say, black and white issues that are so prevalent where we need journalists of color. But then we have, you know, those more subtle, culturally competent skills that, you know, journalists of color bring to, you know, the table. I was reading something, and I don't know what it was. It was just the other day, and this is a prime example where, you know, someone was talking about Kamala Harris. And the, as it was put, I think it was either the New York Times or someone else, where it said the screeching noise that her sorority sisters make. And when I read it, I really laughed, having, you know, attended an HBCU. That's it. And the first thing I thought, screeching, what screeching noises? What are they talking? What are they talking about? You know, and then I said, oh, you mean the ski-wee thing? Yes, I get it. But, you know, because we didn't call it a screeching noise. but that, you know, that's the kind of thing that you need, you know, journalists of color. And not just color of skin, but again, culturally competent journalists of color to really understand the nuances of some of these issues, Kelly.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. I was chuckling a little as you said that, because I knew you were going to reference that. And as soon as that article came out, I texted all my AKA friends to share it. You know, I would actually say that we need journalists of color because we can cover anything, and we can cover anything with nuance, right? We tend to have more diverse, as you said, multicultural points of view. You know, an example of is exactly what you mentioned, the article about Kamala. So many of us already knew she was an AKA, so we knew, you know, what that sound would have been, even if we weren't writing it. You know, having editors of color would have been probably able to figure out what that was, even if they weren't there and didn't know. So, we can really cover anything. And I want to say that also, to me, what's really significant in this particular time is that we need more Black women journalists. Mm-hmm. And stories about Black women, particularly because the stories about Black voters tend to be so monolithic and do not dive into the diversity, the rich history and diversity of our communities. And we are really well positioned to be able to tell those stories because I believe that Black women voters, Black women candidates really are driving Democratic politics in this moment.
Let me go back to the phone lines, 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Sandy, calling from Maryland. Thanks for calling, Sandy. What's on your mind?
Hi there.
Hi.
I just wanted to say that, you know, I feel for myself and a lot of my friends, and I'm older, I'm, you know, in the senior citizen almost, and that President Trump has not followed through with anything that he said he would do. And he has caused so much stress and tension between all people that we've lost our government, and we need to take it back. And people are fed up, you know, we're totally fed up with the rhetoric that he throws out, and he thinks it's funny. And he's talking about people's lives. And when he was on The Apprentice, I think that's the only reason why he was there, because he didn't have anywhere else to go because he was so broke. And he thought, oh boy, they like me. And then he took it further as a joke, and unfortunately, he got voted in as president, and it's just been 1-4 years of absolute nightmare. And people, it's tiring. You know, the stress of his insanity has literally made everybody fed up.
Okay. Well, thank you so much, Sandy. I appreciate it. To Sandy's point, Cherie, I wonder, I look at, for example, the kind of attacks that the president has made on Yemese Alcindor with PBS. And, you know, hats off to her for enduring these withering attacks by the president. And she has handled these things professionally and with grace and the like. And from your perspective, it's easy to say, yes, I'm going to be a professional, but you are human. Kelly is human. I'm human. And to have the most powerful person on the planet point you out has to give you pause.
I think it does. And I'll point out that, the same day that Kristen Welker was slated to moderate that presidential debate, there were negative tweets from President Donald Trump about her. And she played it down the middle. She was fair, and she did an excellent job. I think that you have to, you know, drown out the noise. And, I mean, I talked to April Ryan a while back about, you know, some of the things she endured, because she kind of took the first jab before Yemish, you know. And so this sort of, I'll tell you one story. You might not have known this, but in 2016, our journalists here in Philadelphia tried to get, press passes to Trump rallies. And none of the people of color were permitted the press pass. So those are the types of things we had to endure as journalists, not having even access to be able to cover this president in some instances. And this was, of course, when he was a candidate. And part of that was they looked at us and said, oh, you're a black woman. You probably feel a certain kind of way. And so you're kind of judged by the fact that you are a black journalist and the fact that you may be a person of color. A woman as well, and they automatically assume your politics. So I think you have to be extremely, professional in the way that you handle things, because people already assume things about you because of your color and your gender. And so I feel like black journalists, we actually did a panel this year at the NABJ convention. We had a virtual convention, and we talked about objectivity and race, and how black journalists have to walk the tightrope, because we have to use objective standards in doing our work, because people already assume they know our politics, despite the fact that, as was mentioned earlier in this segment, that, you know, black people are not a monolith, that we have all sorts of histories and viewpoints that I think are many times overlooked.
And I would say, you know, you brought up, you know, April. April and I went to Morgan together, and I've known April for decades. And the thing that was most troubling, you know, for me as a colleague and a friend, is to see her go through, you know, the fear that that bubbled up as a result of, of the attacks. And thank goodness her news organization was, you know, there to support her. But, you know, for a lot of us, new or veterans, you know, do you have to have a safety plan now, Kelly, when you are, you know, looking at some of these issues as it relates to, you know, if you do, you know, go out, let's talk about pre-pandemic, when we were still seeing some of the rather, you know, muscular, volatile reactions to reporters, you know, over the past 4 years in covering, you know, the president.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I want to say a couple of things. I want to also add Abby Phillips' name into the mix.
Absolutely.
Right? Because Abby Phillips on CNN has also taken her fair share of Trump's ire. So we know it's a pattern with this president of attacking journalists of color, black women journalists in particular. I think it depends on the kind of coverage that you're doing and what you're doing. I've not worried about my physical safety, but I can say that even when I have covered things related to the president, I've gotten death threats on social media And so I think that's the reality that we're living in. And I, you know, I've not had this conversation with other journalists, I think in part because the pandemic has altered some of the way that we're doing business, right? A lot of interviews we're doing on the phone, a lot of, you know, analysis and information we're collecting online, as opposed to all of us sort of being out in the world. But I think that, yeah, safety is a consideration, whether it's your physical safety or if it's your emotional and mental well-being, given that, you know, this president has, I think, weaponized social media now, too.
And you know, Sheree, one of the things that I have an opportunity to kind of compare and contrast is, you know, I covered, you know, Obama McCain in 2008. And, you know, yes, there were, you know, the personalities and the kinds of expressions between, you know, Obama supporters in Denver at the Democratic National Convention and the Republican supporters in Minneapolis-St. Paul. People were excited. They were supportive of their candidates. But one of the things that now, and I remember this in 2016 in Cleveland, covering the Republican National Convention, my colleague covered the Clinton campaign, the Democratic convention in Philadelphia. It was a different kind of supporter for Donald Trump. You know, they were angry. They were, you know, volatile. I can speak about, we can't call this facts. I can only tell you what I was feeling. I didn't feel uncomfortable at the McCain Republican National Convention. I felt uncomfortable in Cleveland, and I'm still trying to piece that together. Things have changed, Sheree.
Mm. Yeah, I would agree. I mean, I practiced law before becoming a journalist, so I did not cover 2008. My first coverage was in 2012, 2016, and of course now 2020. And I do think, just given the boldness of some of the supporters of President Donald Trump, and that extends back to 2016, and they see you again as a journalist of color, they see you as a Black person, they automatically think that you are going to be against them, or that you're not going to be fair, and you're treated in a very negative way. I actually had a Black journalist I work with here in Philadelphia in my newsroom, and he was threatened, and he asked not to be sent, you know, because he was literally threatened at a rally. And so, you know, I don't necessarily recommend pulling yourself out of something because of safety, but we're not required to put our life in danger for a job, and you shouldn't have to, especially for politics. I mean, one of the reasons why you need an informed electorate, and democracy requires that journalists provide fair and accurate facts. It's very sad that the rhetoric has gotten so negative that journalists can't even do their job. But I will say that it has changed. I mean, I was at the 2016 DNC here in Philadelphia, and it was great this year. Now everything was virtual and online, but still, as was mentioned, you get hate if you tweet about something, if you say something online. It's like they find you, and you can even you even feel threatened, and the person isn't really in front of you. So I'm hoping that the rhetoric can tone down, but we've seen so many tweets about my city, Philadelphia, that I don't know if that's going to happen until far, far after the election.
Yeah, I agree with that. You know, Philadelphia has gotten a lot of unwanted attention, mm-hmm. of late. And speaking of attention, and I think it's fair to say, Kelly, that, for example, during his presidency, his two terms, President Obama got a lot of press. Got a lot of press, obviously because of the historic nature of his presidency. But one of the things that kind of has been hitting me, I mean, the first thing I do when I wake up in the morning is I pick up my cell phone because I got to figure out what I've missed overnight in the 3 or 4 hours of sleep that I allow myself, you know, because I want to make sure that the world is still there when I wake up. But, you know, one of the things, if I'm looking at, you know, the Washington Post, for example, I see Trump, 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 Trump. Trump opinion column, Trump, 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 why Trump should, why Trump shouldn't, this is what he did, this is, and I think, you know, from your perspective, is it personality driven, or is there something else that puts us in a, you know, mainstream, the Washington Post or New York Times or LA Times or the, you know, the Philadelphia Tribune, or that Is it just the power of his personality and the actions that he takes, no matter what you think of them, they may be, let's say, unorthodox, I'll be kind, that doesn't allow mainstream media to focus on some of the other issues that people really care about?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting that you made that observation because I don't have any data to back this up, but right. I think he's got to be one of the most covered presidents in history. And I think it's actually because it's good for business. I think that people just can't seem to get enough of him, and it's shock value. And so every day there's something new. I remember a while ago, it was like every Friday we knew someone was going to get fired, or they were going to drop some, you know, incredible policy that was going to infuriate, you know, a large swath of the American public. And so I think the caller actually who called earlier, who talked about him as kind of like the reality show president, is absolutely right. That's how he's governing. So it's the shock value. And I think that the media often can't get enough. Now, having said that, I think it's also because he's done a lot of things that have really harmed people. And so, you know, the pandemic is a really good example that, you know, we have, you know, scientists and medical professionals telling us what we need to do to, you know, combat this disease. And he's out there saying, but I'm going to do what I want to do, and I'm going to hold these big rallies. And, you know, if people are masked, that's fine. If they're not, that's fine, too. I don't care about social distancing. I mean, so it's almost like, It's like a bad traffic accident where we can't look away. And the media, I think, is also guilty of that.
Yeah. Your thoughts about that, Cherie?
Yeah, I mean, I do think that with the rhetoric, I mean, we do turn it up. I have to say that I think that in some instances, we do run away with different stories And I'm sorry, could you repeat the question?
Well, it's just
in the middle of this.
No, that's all right, because you are working, aren't we all? But
we are.
I was just talking about the kind of attention that President Trump has gotten, more, I would argue, than any president, perhaps in modern history, even more than President Obama during his 2 terms. And it's just amazing to me, whether it's because of things that have just happened things that he does or says that are so consequential that black media, mainstream media, and some of the other specialized media, we all run and are constantly talking about it, writing about it, reporting on it, that so many other important things get left behind.
It's true. I think this has been a race. I don't know if you all feel the way I do, but it's exhausting.
Let me tell you.
It's exhausting. And we've been running full steam ahead for 4 years, okay? And, you know, you think, and I produce a weekly show, syndicated show, and I tell you, I had to blow out my show several times because stuff shifted literally hours after it was recorded. So, and you don't know what it's going to be. You don't even try to predict anymore because it is seriously like a reality show. And I think the president is very good at You know, we have climax on climax on climax, another crescendo, right? And I'll give you one example. I mean, we probably mentioned this earlier, but the COVID, the fact that he got COVID-19 shifted everything. And then he was back out on the trail like just a few days later. Fine. I mean, it's so many things. And the fact that he didn't wear a mask. And you think about black media, when Herman Cain died, you know, one of the few black Republicans out here, he's out there with no mask. And, of course, he dies. This was like a big story for us. As black people and black media, because our family members were dying of COVID-19. I lost an aunt to the virus. And so you think about, you know, you see the president walking around, no mask, having mass spreader parties. For black people, that is a big deal because we are suffering. And the fact that he wouldn't mention race or condemn white supremacists. I mean, you watch any media post-debate, and that's all they were talking about, is that he refused to condemn these white supremacists. And so, yes, black media, we kind of drag them sometimes because our issues are not dealt with or not dealt with appropriately. And he says we're nasty and we don't we're not fair. But we have to protect. A part of what we do is look at it through the lens of how policies, how actions will impact communities of color, specifically black people. And so, you know, we got to call them out. That's part of our job. Watchdog.
And I think you make an excellent point, particularly when it appears, and again, I don't necessarily have the numbers to back this up, but I find this really strange that there seems to be a sense of more highly visible black people and black women who are supporting President Trump, even, you know, after Charlottesville or, you know, the white supremacist comments and all of these other kinds of issues. And I'm fascinated, you know, Kelly, and I would, you know, love to see it, and maybe I need to look it up. If there are any stories that focus specifically on hearing the voices of black women that support Donald Trump, who have really cogent arguments and they don't sound like they're drinking the Kool-Aid. And I think that's one of the things that I find, because we've had them on this program as well. And the thing that I've really tried to do is to get them to stop doing the talking points and talk to me about why. Why? Just like, you know, the progressives who support Joe Biden. Don't give me the talking points. Mm-hmm. Don't give me the, you know, that's, you know, President Obama's buddy, coattails. I don't want to hear about coattails. I want to hear about the here and now. And it just really fascinates me. And again, this goes back to not only, as you said earlier, we don't just need, I think you or Sharice said this, we don't just need a black-owned media. We need journalists of color and specifically women who can get underneath and into the details of that, and I have yet to really see a report on you know that heartfelt. This is why I like, you know, Donald Trump. It's amazing to me.
Yeah, I have not seen a lot of coverage about that either. I've seen more coverage about black men supporting Trump.
Right.
So I would also be interested in the stories of black women, particularly those who, as you said, to give cogent arguments about why they support him. I think probably why we're not seeing enough of that is that statistically a number, that's not going to make much of a difference. But I think, you know, what's interesting about all of what we've talked about is that, you know, we're not, regardless of who wins, regardless if Biden wins, we're not putting, you know, what's been unleashed back in the box.
Right.
Right. You know, and so we're going to need to have some of these conversations, particularly among the black community around the support for these kinds of policies that have been so harmful.
you know, because the worst of it is just not over. You know, when we think about, you know, COVID, when we think about voting rights, when we think about racial unrest, you know, I say that this presidency has aged us all in dog years. but you know, we're really going to have some really hard conversations because, you know, what's been unleashed just where there's no turning back at this point.
Sheree, I'll let you have a final word.
Yes. Well, I would say that, you know, we just have to get people to go vote. I have spent every ounce of my energy as a journalist educating our electorate and talking to people about their duties and what they need to know in order to cast their ballot. And I feel like as Black journalists, part of our job is to be watchdogs of our most sacred right in this country, and that is the right to participate in this democracy. So I've seen voter suppression up close. I've seen all the different court cases that are currently being filed, all the blockages by the Republican Party to keep Black people from the polls. And it floors me every time I think about it. And so my energy is going to be spent in these last few days making sure our voters have access to the polls and that regardless of who they decide to vote for, that it is as easy as our states allow and they get the opportunity to do that unfettered.
Yeah. Just a little bit of breaking news just coming down. The Supreme Court is allowing North Carolina to extend the deadline for receiving mail-in ballots. It's a defeat
yes.
for GOP key mm-hmm. battleground. You know what just happened. Amy Coney Bryant is on that Supreme Court. Who knows? I think that is also going to be consequential. And I would be surprised if she is full of surprises. You just don't know how this is going to play out. So I'm going to continue to watch that as well. Boy, lots to talk about. Sheree Gregg. Kelly Macias, thank you both for talking to us. I have completely enjoyed your voices. Keep doing the work that you're doing. And NABJ, stay strong up there.
Thank you for having us.
Absolutely.
Yeah, thank you so much.
We also want to thank Dr. Michael Fauntroy for participating in this conversation. That is The Daily Drum on SiriusXM Channel 141 for this Wednesday, October 28th. I'm Harold Fisher. Now, stay tuned for Unheard with Wes Hall. Good night.